From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Mark Adams stumbled upon the idea of Atlantis when he was reading about Plato. The philosopher had written about this mysterious civilization that had sunk into the sea 9,000 years before. Now, of course, Adams had heard the stories about Atlantis, though he thought about them with the same kind of suspicion as stories about UFOs and Bigfoot. But he thought if Plato, one of history's greatest minds, had written about Atlantis, maybe that was different. In his new book, Adams describes this search for Atlantis as a virus, and he confesses he himself was exposed. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his own search and his exploration of this culture of scientists and amateurs determined to find the truth about the lost city of Atlantis. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Mark Adams is joining us to explain what he found when he went looking for the lost city of Atlantis. The philosopher Plato wrote about a marvelous city that disappeared thousands of years ago. We should say up front that Adams is a journalist, and he's as skeptical about these stories as you'd expect him to be, but in the book he confesses his own fascination with the story. So part of the book is him exploring the various theories about Atlantis. Part of it is also his own search. The book is really funny, by the way. It's also a travelogue and a character study of a fascinating subculture of people obsessed with one of history's greatest mysteries. The book is called Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. Mark Adams is a journalist and an author. His work has appeared in GQ, the New York Times, among many other publications. He's also the author of Mr. America, about health guru and millionaire Bernard McFadden, and also the book Turn Right at Machu Picchu. He's joining us today from a studio in Bronxville, New York. And Mark Adams, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess, let's see, where should we begin? Let's start with the assignment that you took on a few years ago, which got you into reading about the philosopher Plato, because this is kind of your way into the story. Let's start there.
Well, you know, it's one of those magazine assignments. And when you're a freelance magazine writer, there are periods when work is dry and you have to take pretty much anything that comes along. So a friend of mine called up and said, how would you like to draw up a list of the 10 greatest philosophers of all time for this magazine for working mothers and digest their philosophy into sort of tips to help our readers get through the day?
Yeah.
And I should have, you know, seen the red flag right away, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And I started digging into this. I called all these philosophy professors and everybody I called had the same response. I said, top two philosophers, Plato number one, Aristotle number two. After that, you can argue a little bit.
Right.
You know, once I started getting into Plato, I realized that the reason why this was going to be such a horrible assignment is because Plato's writing is extremely vague and allegorical and confusing. And people are, you know, 2,400 years after, you know, Plato's heyday, people are still arguing about what he meant, even in some of his most famous texts like The Republic. So, you know, I started looking into this and I got into like simpler and simpler introductory to Plato texts. And I finally got to one by a professor named Julia Annis. And one sentence stood out for me. It said, in terms of the impact it had or something to that effect, the most important thing that Plato ever wrote or the most impactful thing he ever wrote was the story of Atlantis. You know, and that's the moment when you hear the needle scratching across the record and you're like,
wait, whoa.
You know, I've just spent a month, you know, looking at Plato's attempt to describe the universe and you know, see if there's a perfect form of the one great God and, you know, talk about virtue. And all of a sudden, you know, we're taking a left turn towards Atlantis here. So that, you know, once you see something like that, it sticks with you.
But what was your knee-jerk reaction, first of all? I mean, you say in the book that one of the things was you were, you know, you had heard about the story of Atlantis first, but you had not heard of it connected to this great mind, to Plato. I mean,
no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the Atlantis I know is the Atlantis that I think most people know. You know, it's the Disney movie Atlantis. It's the Saturday morning cartoon Atlantis. It's the DC Comics Atlantis in which, you know, Aquaman goes to visit the nuclear-powered underwater bubble city at the bottom of the ocean. And Plato's Atlantis is really not that at all. Plato's Atlantis is he gives a lot of description, and that's why people have gone looking for it. But it is not this super technically advanced, you know, civilization with airships and talking seahorses and such.
One of the things you say early on in the book is that you learned Atlantis is a virus.
Yes.
Talk about that, because as you say, you yourself were exposed.
Well, you know, I mean, the amazing thing, the really irresistible thing about this story, there are many, but the one irresistible thing is the amount of detail that Plato gives. You know, I mean, he gives measurements, he gives landmarks, he names the building materials, he talks about the island's position relative to other places that were known in the ancient world when he was writing this. And almost inevitably, you know, the human mind is programmed to create stories to explain things it can't understand. You find yourself wondering two things. One, was it real?
Right.
And if it was real, where was it? And, you know, I found myself following that same path that all of the people who I tracked down and talked to for the book had found themselves on at some point in their lives.
But there's this, and you talk about this in the book, actually, this your sense of reticence, at least early on. I mean, eventually your objectivity about the issue, as you explain later in the book, begins to evaporate. But early on, I mean, you are a writer, a journalist, and so there is that sense of skepticism that you bring to the task at first. But it's what's so great about it is you also sort of came of age in that era when a lot of us did in the 70s. And you write about all the movies and the television shows that were really about history and myth. In Search of Noah's Ark, you mentioned.
Yep.
Which I saw, which was fantastic. And In Search of Historic Jesus. And of course, then there's the whole Leonard Nimoy thing In Search of, which that was in that era, too.
You know, to see those things at age 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, at the same time you're watching things like Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back for the first time, you know, you start to wonder, you know, is there a gray area between these myths and, you know, history? And the interesting thing about the timing of Plato writing the Atlantis story is, and he himself, you know, argues this in his dialogues more than once, is that it's just after the point where we've gone from, you know, centuries and centuries of oral history, you know, things like Homer passed down the Iliad, the Odyssey, you know, stories in which history is embedded in a myth. And, you know, less than 100 years before Plato writes the Atlantis story, you know, Herodotus, the father of history, says, you know, we really should start writing this stuff down. And Herodotus made up a bunch of stuff or at least wrote down a bunch of stuff that, you know, dog-headed men and things like that in his first great histories. So to sit back and say, you know, there is this gray area, and if we look hard enough, if we don't just dismiss it because Atlantis is supposed to be one of those things like Bigfoot and UFOs and crop circles and whatever, if we don't just dismiss it out of hand, you know, how much can we actually find in these original stories? And the answer is a lot.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff that you encountered, even when you were a young kid, you know, watching the Leonard Nimoy series and stuff like that. Even that, you probably recognized as kind of goofy, but you said it did even then give you this urge to kind of go out and explore and figure it out. Was that the same impulse that took you into this story?
Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought about it that much until I was probably halfway through this book. But somebody pointed out to me. They said, "You know, do you know you're always writing about obsessives?" And I was like, "What?" Yeah. You know, and that's how I got the subtitle of the book. And when I thought about it, I was like, well, you know, a lot of the magazine stories I've written are about obsessives. The first book I wrote, you know, Mr. America, was about a guy who basically thought he could cure everything wrong with America if he could just get Americans to stop eating so much. And by which I mean, you know, fasting for days at a time. He could cure everything from cancer to kleptomania. Yeah. The second book was about the man who sought to find Machu Picchu in Peru and was sort of obsessed with becoming famous and used Machu Picchu as a vehicle to do so. So, you know, I definitely find myself gravitating towards these stories about obsessives who are looking for something that, you know, other people are dubious about and, you know, end up succeeding to some degree.
There's a term you mentioned, Atlantology.
Yes.
Which I guess sort of describes this quest, this obsession. And as you point out, this is a growth industry.
It is. I mean, you know, there's a site that I was eventually led to called the Atlantipedia, atlantipedia.ie. And when I went there, and it's run by a fellow named Tony O'Connell, who's also in the book,
That's great.
He lists every single Atlantis hypothesis that has ever been given. If you count, there have been more put forth in the last 10 years than in the previous 2,300 years. Mm. And people have been arguing about whether Atlantis was real or not since Plato died. I mean, Aristotle weighed in his own vague way.
He didn't. He didn't buy it, really.
Well, we can't tell or not. I mean, the knock has always been that Aristotle said he who created Atlantis also destroyed it.
Right.
But that actually seems to be a conflation of two quotes. And Aristotle actually in other places repeats details that Plato gives in the Atlantis story as if they are very straightforward.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is no more matter-of-fact writer than Aristotle, who's famous for being, you know, dry and you know, categorizing things. And then in the very next generation of students from Plato's university in Athens, this guy named Crantor, who seems to have bought into it wholesale and may have even sent someone to Egypt where Plato says he first heard the story, or where one of his ancestors first heard the story. So people have been debating this going all the way back.
How does conventional science, obviously conventional historians and archaeologists, they've not out of hand, but it's been throughout the years pretty well dismissed, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, what I found soon was that the word Atlantis is sort of career kryptonite.
Right.
people who dip a toe into Atlantis are suddenly grouped with people who are looking for Noah's Ark and, you know, people who are, you know, spend a lot of time fixated on Area 51 and things like that. You know, I did eventually find some people who were willing to talk about it. You know, in sort of a general way, but to sit down and write a serious book about Atlantis would be absolute career suicide. You just can't find archaeologists, anthropologists, historians who are willing to do that unless it's a book saying everybody who talks about Atlantis is nuts.
Yeah.
Those books have been written.
So let's talk about Plato's theory, his idea, because of course this is where the story really takes hold, Atlantis. And you say that the believers and the skeptics, they both tend to agree that on two particular things. One that you mentioned, and that is that Plato embedded very precise details in the story.
Yes.
And I want to talk about that as we go. But also the second part was that he said the story was not only true, but it was based on historical sources.
Yes.
What do we know about what Plato really then, I mean, because, you know, we'll come back to this too, but if you're going to tell a ripping good tale, a really good
yep.
story, you would include both of those. I mean, you know, good ghost stories are all
yep.
about, you know, those same elements.
Well, you know, Plato himself, he doesn't write as Plato. He writes
yeah.
as characters.
Right.
Usually the guy who gets the best lines in every dialogue is Socrates.
Right.
And in The Republic, Socrates says to someone else, when explaining the use of stories for educational purposes, he says, you know, aren't there stories that are true and stories that are not true? And the guy says, yeah, you're Socrates, as usual, you're right. And he says, but maybe there are also stories that are not true but have truth in them. So those are the three, you know, the three shells that we can look under for Atlantis. We've got not true, we've got all true, and then we've got in between. Almost everyone who has ever looked at Atlantis in the past has decided it's either true or completely false.
Right.
And for me, the interesting thing is to say, okay, I'm sure Plato is doing a lot of weird things in here. And as the book unfolds, as you know, we find more and more of those strange things that he might have been doing. But to find, you know, what are those elements that you know, maybe were true. And he does say, I think it's 22 times, you know, this is a true story. The character Critias, who he speaks through, mm-hmm. says that. And what gives the book, you know, probably some more historic heft is that he cites as his source this guy Solon, who is sort of the Thomas Jefferson of Athens. He's a great lawgiver and an ancestor of Plato. So, you know, some have said it would be very unusual for Plato to give Solon as his source. And Solon says he got it while visiting Egypt. And he was in a temple and some priest explained to him the story of Atlantis. You know, it would be odd if Solon were cited as the source and it turned out to be completely false. That just doesn't jibe.
You raise the question of why it is that Plato would sandwich, as you put it, his theories about the creation of the cosmos in his writing between the two halves of these stories of Atlantis. Because, as you say, this tale kind of unfolds in two parts. So why would he do it
does.
That way?
Well, you know, it's even stranger than that because you've got probably, and we don't know anything for certain about Plato, but we think that he writes the Timaeus, which is the work in which Atlantis is introduced, right on the heels of the Republic, arguably the most influential work in the history of Western civilization. And Socrates actually references the Republic at the beginning of the Timaeus, right before they get into the first iteration of the Atlantis story. Then you get the Atlantis story in condensed form, which is that, you know, this island nation had a war with Athens, was destroyed by some sort of watery cataclysm, and then all of a sudden, in one of the strangest segues of all time, they start trying to give some sort of mathematical logic to the universe through the character Timaeus.
Yeah.
And then once Timaeus is done with that, giving this spiel, which was like the most important work in the Middle Ages, a spiel that has been influential in everything from astrophysics to, you know, the establishment of Christianity and monotheism in general, they come back to the Atlantis story, and that's where he gives an even more elaborate account in a dialogue called the Critias. Mm-hmm. So, people have said, maybe Plato invented science fiction in the Atlantis story. You know, maybe he was just illustrating some political ideas that were in the Republic. But the placement is so strange, and it begs further inquiry that people usually are not willing to give it.
One of the theories early on that you mentioned is someone told you that Plato, he believed Plato saw Atlantis as this philosopher king's model. That was ultimately destroyed by natural disaster. Natural disaster is an important element here, which we'll sort of talk about more in detail.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that part of this too? This idea that it was kind of a model that Plato was thinking about.
Well, if it is an illustration of the ideas in the Republic, one of the most important and enduring ideas that he gives in the Republic is this idea of a philosopher king, a king trained from a very young age in mathematics, geometry, music, philosophy, and basically is educated using a Platonic curriculum as he would have taught at the academy in Athens to become, I think it's by the age of 50, a wise ruler. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, then Atlantis may be an example of a civilization that had been ruled by wise rulers like this. He talks a bit about these are all supposed to be sons of Poseidon, which is why you can't, really say, okay, Atlantis is a completely true story unless you buy into the fact that Poseidon was there with his trident. These sons of Poseidon were wise, and then their descendants were wise, and then at some point civilization became debased and Zeus decided to destroy Atlantis with some sort of watery cataclysm. The idea being that once they had fallen from the grace of the philosopher king's model, it was time for Zeus to clean house.
Before we head to a break, will you give us a sense of what this was supposed to look like? I mean, leave Plato's perception of it. First of all, it was this wealthy kingdom. I think you mentioned that Plato was sort of playing the role of kind of urban planner here. He was very particular about the way he kind of laid it out. Give us a sense of that image.
Well, that's the strange thing. He's very precise. He says that the center city is three rings of land with two rings of water, and he gives the exact width of each one. And there are bridges and there are canals of certain widths that, certain kinds of boats can pass each other in these canals. Mm-hmm. And then beyond the city is this gigantic plain, which has a trench around it of 10,000 stadia. Stadia is about 600 feet long, which would be about 1,100 miles long. So, I mean, this is, it's incredibly huge, earthworks project that, if true, would be, you know, impossible. It's many, many times the amount of earth moved to create the Panama Canal. Right. And then in between the plane is this sort of crosshatch pattern. And within each of those crosshatches, he gives a specific number of, you know, chariots, you know, army men, and, you know, who's expected to bring food. And it just goes on and on and on. And it's in this section that he starts spewing out all these very specific numbers that you have to start to wonder, you know, where is he getting all this from? Right. Does someone just make this stuff up off his head?
And it was a massive population, massive army, massive civilization.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you sit down with on the back of an envelope and you know, figure out the numbers he's talking about, we're talking about an armed force of more than a million people.
Yeah. When we get back from a break, we'll start talking about some of the other characters that Mark Adams writes about in his book. Ignatius Donnelly, we'll get to when we get back from a break. Mark Adams is with us again. His book is called Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Mark Adams. We're talking about his intriguing new book called Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. He's joining us from a studio in Bronxville, New York. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. Well, the book is full of extraordinary characters. Some you met, some you didn't. This one you didn't. So I want to start with Ignatius Donnelly, which you describe in the book as really the first great Atlantis fundamentalist, I guess.
Yeah. What happened was up until about 1870 or so, nobody was really looking that hard at these myths for, you know, literal historic truth. And then there was an archaeologist named Schliemann in Germany who looked at Homer's Iliad and said, you know what, I'm going to use this to find the city of Troy. And it's similar to the Atlantis story in that, you know, he says, okay, there's a certain gate here and you know, geological details and stuff like that. So Schliemann in 1871 goes to Turkey and finds it, you know, hires a team to dig and finds what is generally regarded to be the city of Troy, even to this day. You know, he did some crazy things that archaeologists are not particularly happy about. But that sets off sort of a search mania for other ancient cities that have existed in myth and legend up to this point. So about 10 years later, Ignatius Donnelly, who in two different accounts I saw described as the most unheralded great man who ever lived and the greatest failure who ever lived, he's a Minnesota congressman, yeah, retired. Who sits down at his house in a failed subdivision outside of St. Paul and puts together this sort of pastiche of every bit of information he can find related not only to Plato's Atlantis, but, you know, ancient history. He's digging into the Maya and he's reading Sanskrit and he just cobbles this whole thing together and decides that Atlantis, the story is essentially true and that it had been in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and that the Azores Islands are now the tips of what had been the mountains of Atlantis and that it had sunk in a day and a night to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And they had just started doing the first surveys of the bottom of the Atlantic at that time. And he thought that this was proof that his theory was true. And to the degree that William Gladstone, the prime minister of Britain at that time, and himself a Homer scholar, wrote him a very congratulatory note saying, I think you're really onto something here.
That's so interesting that it really took hold. I mean, why would he had no, I mean, beyond his obsession with the story, he really had no credentials to write about it, but it became such an important book in the scheme of things, the book that he wrote.
But that's the story of Atlantology. And I should point out, right, people who search for Atlantis, they don't really like the term Atlantology. Yeah, they don't like to be dubbed Atlantologists. But it's almost always these sort of energetic, curious amateurs who are willing to devote the time to go back to ancient texts and compare things and look at maps and such. And each one comes up with his own hypothesis at a certain point.
I like how Donnelly was inspired in bit, or at least we think maybe by Jules Verne and his 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Well, there are some definite similarities between 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Donnelly's version of events, you know. And one thing about his Atlantis is that this supposedly was the mother culture that sent, you know, boatloads of brilliant people off to found the other great cultures of the ancient world, mm-hmm, from ancient Greece to Egypt to the Incas, et cetera, et cetera. And he spends, like, the second half of the book trying to prove that this was the case. Now, that it's regarded now as what's called hyperdiffusionism, and it's mocked openly in, you know, humanities departments. But that was, you know, his theory, and he was sticking to it.
Well, this idea of a master race.
Yeah.
And the Aryan notion, this absolutely plugs into the Atlantis story.
Oh, yeah. Later picked up by Madame Blavatsky, mm-hmm, the famous theosophist who believed that Atlantis had existed a million years ago. And she's really the one who sort of amps up the idea that Atlantis was this technology, you know, technologically advanced super race. And unfortunately, about 50 years later, the Nazis, after having come into power, you know, they have this new division run by Heinrich Himmler called the Annenerbe. Mm-hmm. And their job is to find ancient myths that can sort of support the idea that the Aryan race goes back all the way to the beginning of time, and they latch onto the idea of Atlantis as one of these great Aryan races, due in part to Blavatsky and Donnelly's earlier work. Mm. And in fact, they're about to launch a big expedition to the Canary Islands to look for the original Atlantis in 1939 when something else happens that gets them off the scent, and that is the invasion of Poland.
Let's talk about Tony O'Connell. He's such a great character. It sounds like you got to be kind of friends.
I mean, Tony, he didn't know what to think of me at first because he does get a lot of strange requests and things. And, you know, I understand. You dip your toe into Atlantis and you're going to get a lot of strange emails and phone calls and such. But Tony is perhaps the most level-headed guy I met throughout all of this. I mean, he's spent more time than almost anyone I know on Earth thinking about Atlantis, and he's still a skeptic. He's not convinced it was true. He's not convinced it wasn't true. But what happened was I went to his site, the Atlantipedia, and I started looking through it, and I was like, God, this is like the only guy who really gets all this stuff. I wonder if I could talk to him. So I said, you know, can we talk about this? And once he sussed out that I wasn't crazy, he's like, you know, why don't you just come over to my house in Ireland and we'll talk about it for a week. So that's what we did. We would go out every morning and have coffee and soda bread, and we would sit down and talk about Atlantis for a few hours. And at the end of the week, we came up with this list of four potential candidates, people who had come up with hypotheses for where Atlantis had been that seemed like the most reasonable of the thousands that are out there.
And you kept checking in with Tony. It's kind of like he's the voice of reason. He seemed to sort of give you some guidance about where to go next or what to make of all of that in some way.
He does. He's like the wise man of the book. You know, every time I get it, I hear something crazy. And I should point out, you know, when you're in the presence of these people, these Atlantologists, you know, everything makes sense. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I understand it when you're sort of swept up in the moment. Yeah. And then you go back and you talk to Tony, and he's like, you know, hold on there, Mark. You know, don't let your head swell.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, Tony, you're right. Okay, I'm getting a little carried away here. You know, but there's just so much, you know, enthusiasm and such a desire among these guys to find Atlantis that, you know, you really need some sort of, you know, governor like Tony standing behind you and saying, okay, slow down there, tiger.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go through some of these ideas. As you say, you broke it down into some possibilities. I'm not sure where to start. Let's start with Tartessus.
Tartessus is generally regarded by scholars to have been a real city. It's referred to in various ancient manuscripts. Yeah, you know, Aristotle refers to a river Tartessus. It may be the same as the city of Tarshish that's mentioned in the Old Testament. That's trading with the city of Tyre, where the Levant is today. you know, there may be some truth in the idea that this city of Tartessus, which probably sat just outside the Straits of Gibraltar in southern Spain, may have been the original Atlantis. And, you know, the two things that make it seem most likely are that Plato says Atlantis was opposite the Pillars of Hercules,
right.
Which is, like I said, generally regarded to be the Straits of Gibraltar, but may not be. Mm-hmm. There are other pillars. I think there are 8 sets of pillars. And he says it's facing a place called Gades, which is the ancient Phoenician name for the city of Cadiz, which is still very much alive in southern Spain. One thing I should point out is that, you know, I get all sorts of emails from people telling me, well, you know, Atlantis sounds like this name in the old such and such language. The one thing we know about the name of Atlantis is that it wasn't Atlantis, because Plato says Solon changed all the names into Greek when he was in Egypt. So whatever the original name was, it could be anything except Atlantis. So the second place was Malta, right, which is, like Plato's described Atlantis, an island city, has the oldest temples in the Mediterranean, 1,000 years older than even the Great Pyramid at Giza. Plato says that Atlantis was rich in temples and statuary and things like that. And it seems to have been destroyed suddenly by a watery cataclysm around 2500 BC, which would echo Plato's destruction of Atlantis. The third possibility, which is the one that scholars take most seriously, is Santorini,
right,
an island off of Greece. Because it blew up around 1600 BC, its remaining shape is sort of like a bullseye, which echoes Plato's concentric circles. And in 1967, some archaeologists found a very old maritime city there that in some ways resembles Plato's description of Atlantis. It was buried under 20 feet of ash. It's called Akrotiri. And they've still only dug out, I think, about 3% of it. I visited it during my journeys there. The fourth candidate is sort of the most modern and the real dark horse of the bunch. Mm-hmm. There was an IT specialist in Germany named Michael Huebner, who took all Plato's dozens and dozens of clues, plugged them into his own personal algorithm, and at the end it spit out almost like playing a game of Battleship where all the red pegs show up in one spot. They all zeroed in on this one spot on the Moroccan coast of the Atlantic coast of Morocco, just outside the Pillars of Hercules. So those are the four places that I ended up visiting with the Atlantologist attached to each.
It's so interesting, the sort of ups and downs in this story. I mean, you talk, you know, you have, as you say, when you're talking to each Atlantologist that you talk to, it sounds pretty convincing. They have a really remarkable theory, but then you start to find these. I mean, one of the things that came to be quite a problem throughout this search was the dating. You know, Plato talked about, he was quite specific, 9,000 years.
Right.
Before his time, and
right,
none
which
of the carbon
it at about 9600 BC,
right, and the none of the carbon dating in any of the sort of archaeological expeditions really worked out.
No, the dates do not match up at all. You know, I mean, one thing that's really intriguing about the date of 9600 BC is that it's just after the end of the last ice age. So maybe people think, you know, there could have been some huge melt and, you know, maybe water spilled over the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles. And, you know, Atlantis was actually a city on the Black Sea that was, you know, suddenly inundated and blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't find a lot of that very compelling. You know, the thing about Plato is that he was a Pythagorean. You know, right after Socrates drank the hemlock around 399 BC, you know, Plato goes on what is essentially the world's first study abroad trip, which eventually takes him to southern Italy, where he finds this group of you know, philosophers called the Pythagoreans, after the people who supposedly found the 3-4-5 triangle theorem. And they are searching for a sort of mathematical code that, you know, describes the universe. It's sort of a cross between, you know, an early physics and numerology, both of which they are considered founders of. So Plato brings this back to Athens, and he's using, you know, Pythagorean lessons at the academy, his university. So the idea that Plato would, you know, embed all of these numbers into the Atlantis story as, you know, pure factual information just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And the biggest red flag is, of course, that 9600 BC date, which, you know, serious scholars, historians always hold that up first and foremost to say, well, this can't be true because nothing was going on 9600 years before the birth of Christ.
There came a point in the Enterprise, which I referred to earlier, where you say your own journalistic objectivity kind of evaporated, as you put it in the book, and to the point where you didn't want to just figure out why people were searching for Atlantis, but you wanted to find it too. Talk about that kind of twist, because this last part of the book is your theory, your search.
I mean, it's definitely my explanation of what I think is true and what is not true.
Yeah.
And you know, not to give anything away, but I like Socrates in the Republic, I think the answer is somewhere in between those two poles of true and false. You know, I don't think you can, you know, get wrapped up in a story like this without, to a certain degree, and I suppose you can if you know, you're a newspaper investigative reporter or something, but without, you know, hoping a little bit that, you know, what the obsessives are searching for turns out to be true. Right. Because, you know, but how fun is that if you get to the end of the story and you're like, oh, guess what? It was all a chimera or something like that. So I definitely, you know, once I had amassed enough information to think, you know what, there is probably what the anthropologists I dealt with in the book call a kernel of truth in here. You know, I really need to find out how big that kernel is.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that. I want to talk about this idea of catastrophe, which really plays a part in the story when we get back from a break. Mark Adams is with us. His book is called Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Mark Adams. We're talking about his new book, Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. I have to say, one of the most fascinating parts of a pretty fascinating book was this section where you write about catastrophism. Mm-hmm. You know, this study of how natural disasters have, influenced events over millions of years. And you talk about this book that you read by this professor named Trevor Palmer called Perilous Planet Earth, which you described as one of the most terrifying books you've ever read. Talk about this idea of catastrophe, how this plays into all of this.
Well, you know, up until around the time of Charles Darwin, the idea that catastrophes such as, you know, earthquakes, floods, you know, 40 days and 40 nights of rain might have had huge impacts on the shaping of the Earth and humanity's history, you know, was pretty much taken for granted. And a lot of that went hand in hand with old time religion. It was like, you know, OK, these catastrophes happen. And the reason why is because God caused them because we were bad. Starting with Darwin, we sort of moved to the exact opposite of that. We want a very empirical science. We don't want to see, you know, any sort of big causes. You know, this is why things like continental drift were sort of sniffed at when they first came out. But in the last, you know, 30 years or so, we've started to come back, especially when the Alvarezes sort of came up with their theory that, you know, a comet or an asteroid had hit the Earth around 65 million BC, and this had, you know, caused a cloud of dust that blocked out the sun and, you know, basically killed off the dinosaurs. The thing that's so terrifying about Trevor Palmer's, you know, it's a textbook, basically. It's the world's scariest textbook. What's so terrifying about it is that he goes through the history and he's like, you know, look, these things are not that unusual. You know, comets, meteorites, asteroids have hit the Earth repeatedly over millions of years. There have been floods. There have been earthquakes. You know, sometimes these things happen in bunches. You know, there's a super volcano under Yellowstone National Park that if it blows, you know, the entire United States west of the Mississippi River is going to be covered in ash to a depth that, you know, you can no longer have agriculture. You know, so all of these things are possible. They just happen so far apart that, you know, we tend to forget over time. And that's actually one of the messages of Plato's Atlantis story, which is the cyclical nature of time. And he says, you know, time and again, advanced civilizations have been wiped out by, you know, comets from, he talks about the Phaethon myth, about this, you know, ball of fire that streams across the sky, burning the earth below, which is a very close description of a meteorite event. And then he says, you know, time after time, floods have wiped out civilization. And Atlantis is one of these stories. And, you know, if you think about that for a second, it has a lot of relevance to something we're probably facing right now, which is climate change. Yeah. And the seas, you know, rising by, you know, hubris, as the Greeks would have said, because we assume we're too powerful to be affected. And Plato would say, sorry, this is just another, you know, turn of the wheel here. It's cyclical.
This is a great character. Bruce, is it Massey or Mass?
Bruce Massey, yeah.
Bruce Massey is this retired archaeologist who talks about, helped you sort of work through that relationship between myth and catastrophe. And if you look at it, you mean the parting of the Red Sea, a massive flood, these things that you see in the Bible, all could be connected to these ideas. And even the Atlantis story itself, you know, a myth, as Massey believes, that came from an actual catastrophe.
Yeah. I mean, part of this new discipline of what's called geomythology is to go back to the original myths and see, you know, whether they are describing catastrophes, cataclysms, you know, as they happen. There's a fellow who went back and looked at an old poem by Hesiod, who was a Greek poet who lived maybe 200 or 300 years before Plato. And it seems to match almost perfectly the description of the explosion of Santorini that created that sort of bullseye-shaped island that, you know, now makes it a candidate for the original Atlantis. There are other people who have looked at, you know, comparing the 10 biblical plagues to the Thera explosion, Santorini explosion of 1600 BC, and that seems to match up. You know, one of the amazing things that Bruce Massey did was he went back and looked at all the ancient flood myths, and almost every old culture has a flood myth of some sort, and, you know, connected the dots and said, you know, look, if you go back and look at Noah's Ark, if you look at Atlantis, if you look at the myth of Deucalion, which is another Greek flood myth, you look at the Epic of Gilgamesh, you know, there are so many similarities between these stories that, you know, they are either A, all coming from a single source, or B, are all derived from a single event, and it looks like it may actually be the latter.
You mentioned how Plato felt strongly about the oral transmission of stories. And so this idea that he may have taken the pieces of an incomplete story, filled in the gaps, just another way of trying to put a cataclysmic event in perspective for his time?
I think so. I think, you know, I think he had two, you know, ideas that he was trying to use the Atlantis story for. I think he was, you know, A, trying to get across this idea of the cyclical nature of cataclysms and, you know, societies rise and fall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the only way to prevent this from happening is to study philosophy, you know, put our faith in philosopher kings, that sort of thing. You know, the other thing was, you know, he's trying to entice these students to engage in, you know, the one activity that can hope to explain all of this, and that's philosophy. And, you know, Plato's philosophy is not easier. So if you give a nice story like Atlantis, you know, that's an open door through which people can walk and you know, take their first steps toward the what Plato would call the higher form of philosophy.
Yeah. As you were putting all this information together to come to your own kind of conclusion, Bruce Massey tells you that, in a sense, you are a little bit like Plato, that you had to kind of sort through all the nuances of all the different people and all the different accounts and make an informed, knowledgeable story. And he asked you this. He said, are you in denial that you're following in Plato's footsteps. And like you're doing now, you kind of laughed out loud at it.
I did. It seemed, you know, so patently ridiculous to me at the moment. And it happened near the end of all my research. And he was actually the first to point this out. He's like, you know, what you're doing is a very Platonic inquiry, you know, looking at every single piece of information, looking at it from every possible angle before you, you know, come up with something that doesn't, you know, pretend to be the definitive truth, but which is, you know, the closest we can come to, you know, what we would call a Platonic ideal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of a mirror image of a mirror image of what might be the truth.
I'm glad you said you didn't want to give everything away, so I'm not going to, because I like some of the conclusions, and I think people should read the book to find out sort of where you came. But so I'll tread lightly here, Mark Adams.
Thank you. You
deal with some pretty basic points, you know, the idea of the islands, at least the ones that Plato mentions. Of course, the islands' particular physical characteristics, the rings you mentioned, there are mountains here, there's that large plain, the canals, those kinds of things. There's that conflict between Atlantis and Athens, which we didn't have time to talk about, but that's intriguing. The Pillars of Heracles you mentioned.
Yep.
A cataclysmic event we talked about that may have possibly destroyed Atlantis. One of the things you also write about, and you sort of referred to this earlier, though, and we don't have to say too much about it, but the numbers, Plato's numbers, because for you, you said it kind of came down to deciphering Plato's numbers. Without giving too much away, what can we say about that part? Because this is super interesting to me.
You know, I think what we can say is the amount that we don't know about Plato's numbers vastly outweighs what we do about them.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about, you know, people a lot smarter than me have stepped up and said, you know, look, the most difficult parts of the most difficult writings from the world's most difficult philosopher are those that deal with numbers. So Atlantis, I think, is the part of Plato's dialogues that has the most numbers of all. So, you know, we're the needle is buried here in terms of difficulty. So I can only tiptoe in a little bit.
Yeah.
That said, you know, having spoken with a lot of people who know a lot about this stuff, there seems to be a sort of Pythagorean structure to a lot of Plato's dialogues, and he seems to be using the numbers themselves as some sort of illustration, possibly to get some sort of information across to his students at the academy. You know, I'm not going to go so far as to say that I cracked this thing like the Da Vinci Code, and you're going to find the absolute perfect answer to Atlantis with GPS coordinates at the end of my book, but I think I've taken this a lot further than anyone else has, and you know, maybe with some surprising results.
Well, there again, I'm going to I'll get close to it, but not say too much about it. There's this scholar.
Well, the question everybody asks when I start these interviews is, you know, where was it?
yeah. Well, but beyond that, this scholar named Jay Kennedy, who found these mathematical and these musical codes, it's almost like the syllables in the way Plato put the story together, like there's some. Like it's a song or a poem that maybe his students at that time, when it's delivered orally, because this was important for Plato, this oral tradition, maybe it would have made sense. They would have gotten it, and we don't get it right now. We've missed it.
You know, in another of Plato's dialogues, Socrates himself says, hey, you know what? I'm not really into this writing thing because you can't argue with it. I like talking it out. If it's going to be philosophy, we got to talk it out. Don't just write it down. You know, so it's absolutely intriguing to me that Plato might have structured these dialogues with a musical code that, you know, is almost like be like a soundtrack or the illustrations in a book or something to give meaning to certain sections of certain works. And of course, I go into a lot more detail in this in the book. But what was doubly fascinating to me was that not only did Kennedy find all this stuff with computers around 2010, I think is when he published his paper, you know, this guy John Bremer in Vermont had been doing it by hand, 50 years earlier and come up with essentially the same answer. So you've got two guys coming at it from two very different angles, coming up with a very similar answer.
Well, let's end with John Bremer. He's this retired educator who you go to his basically to his basement in Vermont. He's 86 years old.
Yep.
What's intriguing about him is that this kind of brings this back to this idea of philosophy again. You know, you have theory, you have all these different ideas. You have GPS coordinates now that plug into this. But it's so interesting that you come back around to the idea of philosophy.
Yeah. I mean, that's what Bremer really stressed to me. And this was at the absolute end of my reporting. And he, you know, basically, you know, he's like the Yoda of the book almost. And I get to him and he's like, you know, remember, we're not just dealing with a story as a story here. We're dealing with the most important philosopher of all time. And he's not going to write anything that is not promoting, you know, his ideals of philosophy about how to live a good life and things like that. And he, you know, he shows me essentially, you know, these numbers, these structures, they're as important a part of Plato's works as the words, or as John Bremer said, they might even be more important. We just don't know yet. So there's so much still buried in these Platonic dialogues that we probably don't even understand.
Well, as you said, everyone wants to know the question, do you think it's real? I'll sort of leave it to you to decide how you want to answer that question. But you kept one of the things, Michael Huebner is one of these, and I'm guessing you found this with others.
Yeah.
He figured, like a lot did, that either Atlantis was absolutely real or it was just a complete fiction.
Right.
Tell me, without maybe giving away too much, where you ended up in that score.
You know, I started at one end. I started thinking, you know, this has got to be completely false. I met a lot of people who are what I call Atlantis fundamentalists, who believe that every single, you know, scrap of information in Plato's dialogues has to be true. Otherwise, it's not worth looking for. But having spoken to all these anthropologists and archaeologists and historians and stuff, and to me, the interesting thing is, as I mentioned before, you know, how big is that kernel of truth once you strip away the mathematical and musical codes, which have some other purpose we don't know yet, and the story elements that he put in there to make it interesting? You know, how much of the original story is based in fact? And I think it's a lot bigger than most people would assume it was. And it was certainly a lot bigger than I thought it was going in.
It's Mark Adams, the author of the book Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City, joined us from Bronxville, New York. Mark, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Braden Child, technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.